when I was younger, I got into trouble a little bit. Maybe I still do, but when I was younger, I really did some dumb things. One of those dumb things that I did was to have a game that I played with my older brother. Now, the game was like a combination between soccer and racquetball. We'd take a soccer ball, and we'd kick it up against the wall in my parents' basement, up against a couch, furniture of some kind. And now, there were two ways of playing the game. You could either play cooperatively, in which case you try to kick it up against the wall and alternate whose turn it is to kick and see how many rallies you could have, or you could play competitively. When you try to kick it up against the wall or the couch and you try to kick it behind the opponent so your brother can't get it. Now, as you can imagine, playing sports indoors led to some destruction of personal property. Sometimes the ball would go high or wide. I remember one time when the ball went both high and wide, way wide. To this day, I cannot remember who kicked it, either me or my brother, but we both vividly remember the sight and sound of the ball crashing into this giant shell thing hanging on the wall. Now, when I saw it crash and saw it in a million different pieces, I thought, what's the big deal? I mean, I had never even really noticed it was there before. My brother, though, knew otherwise. He knew we were cooked. And sure enough, we were. When our dad came home and saw what we had done and that we'd been playing soccer in the house, yes, we got into trouble. All the while, I was still thinking, what's the big deal? Now, it took some explaining to me that this shell thing hanging on the wall wasn't just a shell thing, but it was the largest horseshoe crab shell that either of us had ever seen before. In fact, it's the largest horseshoe crab shell that most people have ever seen before. The thing was the size of a Thanksgiving serving platter. It was just huge. But even more than that, the reason why he cared just a whole lot more than what I thought he did or thought he should is because the horseshoe crab shell was found during a family vacation. When the whole family was together, walking along the beach, having a great time. Maybe it wasn't so much about the destruction of a horseshoe crab shell. Maybe it was more about the destruction of the memories of a vacation with a family. Either way, for whatever reason, it was obvious that he simply cared a lot more than I thought he would. A lot more than what I thought he maybe even should. Maybe you know somebody like that. Maybe you know somebody who just cares about things a lot more than you think they should. Maybe your neighbor cares about what his lawn looks like more than you think he should. It's always green. It looks like AstroTurf no matter how hot or dry the summer gets. And you just try to keep your weeds from spilling into his yard to keep the peace, right? He just cares a lot more than you do, a lot more than maybe even you think he should. Maybe even you've been on the other side of things where you're the one caring, trying to do your good deed of the day, or let's be honest, week or month. You decide to let somebody borrow your car. Now, this is a big deal. And you know how much it would mean to this other person. But you say, okay, you can borrow the car, but I absolutely have to have it back by 3 o'clock. No, seriously, it needs to be back by 3. I gotta pick up the kids, go over to the grocery store, make and serve dinner. Please, 3 o'clock. Sure enough, 3 turns into 3:30, 4... 4:30, the car is finally back. Oh, traffic. Traffic kept you an hour and a half late in Grand Rapids. That's a great excuse. I'm sure that's what happened. I didn't have a chance to return my 20 phone calls. What's the big deal? The big deal is that my kids had to wait outside in the rain while I picked them up over an hour and a half late. The big deal is that I didn't get to the grocery store and didn't have anything to make for dinner, and now the kids are going to have to eat another hot and ready, which wouldn't be so bad, except for they've had four hot and readies already this week. I guess the big deal is just that I care. I care more than you thought that I would. I care more than you think that even I should. God's like that too. There's a few stories in the Bible about times when God just simply cared. He cared more than we thought he would. We cared more than, honestly, maybe even you and I think that he should, but still, he cares. We continue our series now on the supernatural Exodus, stories about how God rescued his people, the Israelites, out of forced labor, out of slavery in the land of Egypt, brought them into the wilderness where they wandered around for 40 years, and before he finally made good on this unbelievably wonderful promise of bringing the people into their own place, into their own land, where they can build houses and plant vineyards and grow grapes and just settle down and have their own space. But before we do, we drop in on these incredible stories, supernatural stories, and there's so many that we have to just skip right over. But last week we heard about how God rescued the people, brought them out by demonstrating once and for all that there is no God out there except for him. What do you trust? And he demonstrated through the plagues that only he is worthy of our trust, and he won't let us down. This week, though, we continue this series by going to a more bizarre place. Now, in full disclosure, I have to warn you that this passage isn't from the book of Exodus, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, but no, it's actually from the book of Numbers, which comes right after that, but nevertheless, it's still part of the Exit story, the story of the exit from Egypt. We're going to drop in on it from Numbers chapter 20, and I want to set it up here just a little bit by telling you some background information. The people have been wandering around in the desert for 40 years. 40 years they've been wandering around waiting for God to make good on this promise. And at the tail end of the Exodus story, the exiting story, this happens in Numbers chapter 20. Verse 7 to 12, where God says to Moses and Aaron, he says, take the staff, assemble the congregation, you and Aaron, your brother, tell the rock before their eyes to yield its water. So you shall bring water out of the rock and give them a drink to the congregation and their cattle. And Moses took the staff before the Lord as he commanded him. Then Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly together before the rock, and he said to them, hear now, you rebels, shall we bring water for you out of this rock? And Moses lifted up his hand, struck the rock with his staff twice, and water came out abundantly, and the congregation drank, and their livestock. And the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, because you did not believe in me, to uphold me as holy in the eyes of the people of Israel. Therefore, you shall not bring this assembly into the land I have given them. A couple things strike me as odd in the passage here. You can tell the instructions that he gave, that God gave to Moses, was threefold. Take the staff, assemble the congregation, the people, and speak or tell the rock. Take, assemble, speak. And instead, Moses changes the directions just slightly in execution, and he takes the staff, he assembles the people, he speaks harshly for that to them. Hear now, you rebels, he says. And then he strikes the rock twice instead of speaking to it. Now, I'm looking at that, and honestly, I'm thinking, this is not a big deal. I mean, sure, he didn't follow the directions exactly. It's maybe inexact obedience, but it's obedience nonetheless, right? But God says to him in his curious last verse, because you did not believe in me to uphold me as holy in the eyes of the people, you shall not bring this assembly into the land I have given them. Oh, wait a second. Just because Moses was obedient, though inexact obedience, he doesn't get to lead the people into the land? He doesn't get to be part of God making good on the promise of the land? I mean, it sounds harsh, doesn't it? I mean, it sounds a bit excessive. Especially when you look at everything that the people have been to. I mean, last week we dropped in and Moses was listening to God, going before Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, this major superpower, and demanding that the king, Pharaoh, that he let these people go. I mean, Moses was obedient then, right? I mean, countless times throughout the journey, God gives Moses instructions, and then the tag that goes along with it was, and Moses did exactly what God had commanded him, and Moses did exactly what God has commanded him over and over and over again. I mean, Moses was so obedient, and oh, what Moses had to put up with. It's incredible. You know, soon after those plague stories happened, soon after God demonstrated forcefully that he is the only God, that he is the only one who can be trusted, and that he won't let his people down. After the plagues, the people go out and they camp out in front of Sinai. Moses is gone for just over a month. When he comes back down from the mountain where he was convening with God, by the way, the people had taken all of their jewelry, melted it down in the shape of a baby cow made out of gold, and they worshipped it, replacing God. It took just over a month after the plagues, after the hail and the locusts and the livestock and the boils and the blood and the frogs. But still, Moses kept with him. But still, Moses was obedient. It sounds harsh that just inexactly following the directions here, after this long history, striking the rock instead of speaking to it, would be grounds for Moses not ever getting to come into the land, not ever getting to see it firsthand. Now add to that, over in Exodus chapter 17, verse 6. This story, by the way, has happened before. In fact, this exact story happens before, 40 years before. You could even say it forms kind of a bookend, an open and close to the wilderness story. When they're just starting, they're wandering in the wilderness for 40 years. God has a conversation with Moses where he tells them, hey, the people are thirsty. Everybody's thirsty. And by the way, I always imagine this rock, you know, as just this small thing that he, you know, speaks to it or strikes it and it flows, you know, like a stream. But it says that everybody in the entire nation of Israel had enough to drink from it and their livestock. So beside the point, but you know, I think just imagine, you know, something much, much bigger probably than what you might have in your mind. But Exodus 17, verse 6, where this has happened before the wilderness journey, behold, it says, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall drink the rock, and water shall come out of it. And you shall strike the rock, and water shall come out of it, and the people will drink. And it says, and Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. Now, wait a second. Over in Exodus, it says, strike the rock and water will come out of it. And Moses did so, and everything was fine. And now here, 40 years later, God says, okay, now speak to the rock and water will come out of it. And Moses strikes it. And then, boom, that's enough. Moses can't go into the land. I mean, What if he just got a little confused, you know? Like, hey, last time we did the rock thing, God, we did this whole thing and you told me to strike it, and I guess I got a little confused, you know, mixed up these instructions with the last instructions. Nevertheless, this is apparently enough to bar Moses from the land. It seems harsh, I think. Now, there's plenty of observations or ideas that people have floated out there to say, well, maybe the punishment did fit the crime. Maybe God really is just. You know, Moses did have a history with anger. Maybe this was striking the rock, yelling at the people. Maybe it was just the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak. Maybe it was just one incident too many. For example, you know, Moses, when God found him so many years ago, he was on the run. He was a fugitive. He was a fugitive because he got angry and murdered an Egyptian man. You remember when Moses went up on top of the mountain and the people made the golden calf, he came down. He came down with two stone tablets that God carved in 10 instructions for the land that we know as 10 commandments. You know, he took those stone tablets. He was so mad that he threw them at the ground and shattered them. He had to go back up on the mountain to get a second set. This is a man who struggled with anger and now striking the rock twice, yelling at the people. Maybe that was just, you know, too much. God says, we're dealing with your anger now. The punishment still seems harsh to me, though. You know, maybe it was just that Moses was a leader. You know, and the leader had a different set of standards on him than everybody else, right? You know, over in James, New Testament, I know it's a long time later, but James chapter 3, verse 1 says that none of you should presume to be teachers because teachers will be judged more harshly. Maybe that's true for Moses, right? After all, in Leviticus, which is another book that happened just around this time, it says that, be holy, therefore, as I am holy, God says. Maybe the standards were just so much higher just because of the position that Moses was. That's why it seems harsh to us. But it was just back then. I don't know. It still seems harsh to me, doesn't it? You know, one of the more interesting observations, I think, was that in Hebrew, the word for complain is the same word as remain. And so when the people were complaining out in the wilderness about this, that, or the other thing, not having enough food or drink, or just the conditions being better and forced labor than it was here in the wilderness, they were complaining, but they're also remaining, right? It's the same word. They're kind of mentally, emotionally, they were remaining in the past and not in the present or the future. And so God says, listen, if you want so desperately to remain, to complain, then I'll give you what I want. And that's grounds for 40 years wandering around in the wilderness. 40 years, by the way, represents an entire generation of people. The generation of complainers, of remainers, remained there in the desert and never got to see the promised land. And now Moses is the one gathering the people around, and instead of take the assembly, gather the people and speak to the rock, he's taking the staff, he's gathering the people, he's yelling at the people, he's grumbling, you rebels, he's complaining and striking the rock. And now maybe God is saying, Moses, if you want to join them being complainers, so be it. You can. If that's the desire of your heart, you will remain in the desert just like the previous generation. And he's not allowed to come into the land. You know, I think it's an interesting observation, and there might be something to it, but the text here never says that he complained, remained. The word is never used. And even after all, was he really complaining? I mean, the people were rebels. Because it just seems harsh to me. Last one here. I think maybe the one with the most merit is an interesting choice of words here. Moses represented God's leadership to the people. Moses was often given instructions by God, and he would pass them along verbatim. Interesting choice of words that Moses has here when he yells at the people. He says, "Hear now, you rebels, shall we bring water for you out of this rock?" He changes. Instead of, "Shall God have to bring water out of this rock again?" He says, "We." Now, because the word structure here, the "we," doesn't refer to just like he and God, kind of in this partnership type of deal, or the "we" refers to he and Aaron. He kind of humanizes this entire experience. It robs it of its supernatural, kind of divine origin. Some people have observed that he makes himself out to be the one who's providing instead of God. And that was the true sin, I guess you could say, the true folly, fall of Moses. I don't know, though, because it seems to me just a poor choice of words, but was he really intending to replace God? I don't think that we could say that, not after everything else that he says. You know, the bulk of the story just shows that Moses is completely putting himself before God. I mean, even just before in this story when he meets God, he falls face down in front of him. I don't think he meant to replace God. Seems more like an innocent, poor choice of words than anything else. Even so, it still seems harsh, doesn't it? It seems harsh because if that's what God would do to Moses, if that's the punishment that God would inflict on Moses for such a small mess up, what might he say about our last week? Or about what we get into in the week ahead? I'll tell you that the nerves come for me not just because of how Moses was dealt with so harshly, but because I worry that God would act harshly toward me or towards us. I could be guilty of the same thing or worse as Moses without the long track history to back me up. I guess it just comes down. There's no real explanation for it. The fact of the matter is that God simply cares more than we think he does. Is that when it comes to inexact obedience, in God's eyes it's still disobedience. That no matter how big or how small, God just cares. Maybe even more than we think he should care. Now, this isn't going to come as way of a... This might not make any of us feel any better, and that's certainly not the point of the story, I don't think. If anything, it's possibly just the opposite. But just by way of maybe explanation. What if God has a perspective that we don't? What if God is looking on and maybe more of an eternal perspective than a temporary one? You know, or if you hang around Encounter for long enough, you'll start to hear us talk about trajectories of the heart, right? So, for example, what if What if you take any virtue, you know, or the fruit of the Spirit, right? Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, righteousness. Patience is a good one. What if tomorrow you're just a little bit more of a patient person than you are today? Not much, just a tiny bit more patient. You know, and what if that patience started to build over time? Now seasons, you know, patients come and go, but by and large, over your lifetime, you're getting to be more and more of a patient person. Now, what would your life look like in 10 years? If you're getting slowly but surely more and more of a patient person, what would people say about you in 30 years? Now, here's the kicker. From God's perspective, is that we don't have just 10 or 30 years, but we have a beginning, and he tells us that we just go on and on forever. And he's got this eternal perspective, this infinite perspective. Now, what if we're becoming more and more of a patient person, except for this doesn't last over the short term of 10 or 30 years, but what if it lasts over an infinity, over an eternity? And what if God was doing this in so many different hearts with so many different people all over the world, and they're all gathered together in one place in order for an infinity, over an eternity, they were becoming more and more of a patient people, a loving people. What would you describe? How would you describe that place? In a word, heaven. Now here, I think, is a pretty good example of the opposite happening. What if you take something that Moses struggled with, like anger, and you said, what if tomorrow you're becoming a little bit more of an angry person? And over the course of 10 or 30 years, you became more and more angry. And what if all of the people who are becoming slightly more angry, they're on a trajectory towards anger, and you gather them all up in one place over an eternity? How would you describe that place? In a word, hell. If the trajectory of our hearts is toward God, or if the trajectory of our hearts is away from God, it makes all the difference. I think God wants to do whatever he can to rescue us from the brink of hell. That we think, why does he care so much? Well, it's because he's seen it happen millions of times throughout all of history. I find it odd that taking a stamp from work falls under the same category, falls under the same commandment as embezzling hundreds of thousands of dollars. Thou shalt not, do not steal. I think that's harsh, isn't it? To kind of lump it all together and to say, this is all disobedience, this is all sin. What if God, over the course of human history, has seen embezzlers, millions of them, come and go throughout thousands of years of human history, right? This sort of thing has been happening for a long, long time. And God looks down and says, you know how they all got their start? The stamp. It's how it always started. So cut it off there. Jesus says in the New Testament now, in red letters, Sermon on the Mount, you know, real popular stuff. He says, you've heard, don't commit adultery, another commandment. Jesus goes on to say, but I tell you that even if you look at someone lustfully, you've already committed adultery with them in your heart. Now, come on, Jesus. Looking and doing are two totally different things. Maybe. Or maybe with God's eternal perspective, he has seen millions of marriages crumble. And to a T, every single one of them have started with a lingering glance. Cut it off there. I think God cares more about the little things of disobedience. I think he cares more than we think he should, because he wants to rescue us from a life that looks more like hell than heaven. God just cares. But God also cares. That's the good news too, is that he deeply cares. He cares so deeply that he would do whatever it takes to atone, to pay for these sins that we commit, along with Moses. In just a minute, we're going to celebrate communion together. This is a time when God is present mysteriously here. And this is a time when we celebrate and we remember and when we experience a God who breaks himself, who gives his body, Jesus Christ, on the cross, because he cares. If this is your first time here at Encounter, if this is your first time in church in general, we just want to say that we hope that this will be a meaningful experience for you, that you're okay just standing up for a little while. That's okay. Well, there's going to be songs over top. It's not going to be odd if you choose not to participate, but if you're on the journey with Jesus, if you believe that God cares enough for you to give up his own life, no matter what your church background or lack thereof, we hope that you'll celebrate communion with us. There'll be more instructions after a short prayer and some songs, and we'll celebrate together the God who cares.